So why do you think it is that we have sexism? Why do we have racism? Why is there xenophobia? My idea is that there's fear behind all of those things and the other isms as well. And scarcity, austerity, will drive all of those fears to a higher pitch. So if you are in the traditional majority and then there seems to be less and less of what you need, it isn't difficult for shysters to point you towards blaming other people who aren't really to blame. Propagandists will get you to believe that the reason you don't have as much money from the same amount of work is because there are now women in the workforce, or there are now black and brown people, more of them, in the workforce, and that people from other countries are squeezing you out of your job. And with all of those people competing for work, it's easy for employers to lower the wages that they used to offer you, and then you're forced to take lower and lower wages. That whole line of reasoning is a very easy sell. The only problem with it is that it's not true. The shysters tell you what's going on from their agenda, which is to get everyone's work for hardly any money. If you really want to put your finger on the problem, you need to finger the shysters. And the shysters are either the oligarchs themselves or their paid flunkies. Scarcity is not the result of women or minorities or people from other countries entering the workforce. Scarcity is the result of the monopolists who have rewritten the rules of the game of monopoly to favor them. Before that, maybe it was just the game of life, but now it has become the game of monopoly. And if we want to fix this shit, we're going to have to oust the monopolists. I was out walking with my daughter in a nice neighborhood this morning, and we saw all of these Biden-Harris signs next to Black Lives Matter signs. And all of this is lovely if there's no scarcity. But if we vote for Joe Biden, we're not going to solve that problem of scarcity. If we vote for Joe Biden, we'll have more of what we've had with Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Why don't I mention the Trumpster? I'll come to that point when I get to what global Trumpism is. Global Trumpism, according to the person who coined that phrase, is not thinking merely right Trumpism. He says there's also a left version of Trumpism, and we'll get to that. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag too soon. So let's start our feast out with, "So we vote Trump out, then what?" by Lauren Martinchek. Even if we vote the president out of office, there are still plenty of reasons to fear what happens next. Since before he was even elected to office, many have argued that Donald Trump was an existential threat. Considering the events that have taken place in the year 2020 alone, and the hundreds of thousands of lives lost due to his lethal sociopathy, narcissism, and incompetence, I'm sure many who have made that claim feel justified in their earlier assessments. As we get closer to the general election and attempt to gear up for what is likely going to be a nightmare in the days and even weeks that follow it, part of me still wonders about what happens after even the best possible outcome. Imagine, for argument's sake, that Donald Trump is defeated in this upcoming election. Not only that, but he is defeated in such an overwhelming fashion, the results are confidently in Joe Biden's favor on election night, leaving Donald Trump unable to effectively challenge the results in court, as has been the game plan all along. Then what? The battle would be won, but what about the war? Frankly, the conversation about the threat that Donald Trump poses in the short term is convenient and has consequently been drilled into the mindset of any rational human being who can acknowledge it. It's hard to ignore that as a nation, we've been so focused, and understandably so, on the reality that Donald Trump is willing to burn this nation to the ground for the preservation of his own power, that we're forgetting what will rise up out of the ashes he would leave in his wake. This is me talking. I have to say, that's somewhat of a mixed metaphor there, Lauren. It's also somewhat hyperbolic, but we'll let that go for now. While some among the resistance spent years calling him Drumpf and mocking his spray tan, Donald Trump and those he surrounds himself with have been busy turning the entire base of the Republican Party into a weapon ready in the waiting. While pundits have readily discussed their fears that the president would not leave quietly since before he even took power, the idea of tens of millions of his followers ready to take their guns to the streets in his defense is a little bit more difficult to swallow. The president isn't an existential threat on his own. The thing is, you can vote out a man, but you can't vote out an ideology. And that's more foreshadowing for where we're going in a few minutes. As we dismiss Donald Trump as unintelligent, sociopathic, and incompetent, the fundamental truth behind those words hasn't stopped his ability to seamlessly intertwine a threat to his personal power with a threat not just to the nation, but the entire meticulously ingrained conservative worldview in the minds of his supporters. It hasn't stopped him from carefully nurturing a culture in which conservative white people in particular are willing to throw their own children to the wolves, putting them back in the classrooms and subjecting them to illness and even death from coronavirus, just to prove their allegiance to a billionaire whose only intention is to capitalize on stoking their grievances for his own personal gain. Trump supporter Kyle Rittenhouse murdered two Black Lives Matter protesters and injured a third, and currently finds himself sitting on $1 million worth of donated money for his legal defense. Those who donated to this cold-blooded killer were called freedom-loving Americans and the backbone of America. Is anyone honestly under the impression that an election will stop this? It's easy to identify Donald Trump as a threat. Identifying the underlying problems that led to his rise, like centuries of racism, white supremacy, increasing economic frustrations, income inequality, and the politicization of science, just to name a few, is even more critical. Fascism isn't just coming, it's here. The sooner we acknowledge that going to the ballot box is just the first in a long series of steps in what could be a decades-long fight to eradicate it, the better. So what I want you to take forward from this article into the next articles is the idea that Trumpism is something that will outlast Trump. And also remember in the introduction when I said that the fear of not having enough is also driving Trumpism. It's especially driving the misogyny, the racism, and the xenophobia. Yes, misogynists, xenophobes, and racists are assholes, but you have to admit that scarcity and austerity makes these problems even worse. Now along comes a political economist, Mark Blyth, to explain how the 2008 financial crisis led to political populism. I will link not only to this article, but also to the YouTube video where he explains all of this. How did the middle class end up in perpetual debt? Why is there no money for infrastructure or social programs, but there is for waging war? And what does all this have to do with Donald Trump or Brexit or climate change? If you're mystified about any of the above, then author and Brown University professor Mark Blyth can clarify things for you. He says it's helpful to use a computer metaphor to describe the economy. In his lecture at McMaster University as part of the school's Socrates project, Blythe compared capitalist economies to laptops. Different makes, but similar in appearance. He argues these computers run just fine for a while, say about 30 years, but all the while there are bugs in the software that eventually cause the system to crash. Then you rebuild the hardware, fix the software, and reboot. System breakdown. That's what happened in the 1970s and 1980s when labor costs and inflation became a problem. The system rebuild included less powerful unions, more global trade, and central bankers who were put in charge of setting interest rates. But this new system generated bugs of its own, among them a runaway culture of lending and a lack of wage growth among the middle classes who did a lot more borrowing than they could afford. Blythe says this borrowing wasn't just driven by rampant consumerism. How do you get by when everybody tells you there's no inflation, yet the cost of everything that matters is actually going up? Education, healthcare, all that sort of stuff, Blythe said in his lecture. And the only way you can fill in the gap is to borrow more money. Cue the 2008 financial crisis. However, this time, Blythe says, there was no rebuild. Instead, the United States Federal Reserve led a bailout of the big banks, domestically and internationally. The rich got much richer, the middle class got perpetual low interest rates to keep carrying their debts, and the poor had their social programs cut in the name of austerity. Blythe contends this dynamic is what lit the fuse of global populism. The rise of leaders who appeal to public outrage, alienation, and lack of trust toward career politicians and traditional political parties. Your debts are too high, he said. You can't pay them off, but you can roll them over. They're not going to be eaten away by inflation, and the people who brought you here have zero credibility. Blythe compares populist leaders to rogue code writers hacking into the software of a system that was never properly rebuilt after the crisis of 2008. This is not necessarily a bad thing, especially if it strengthens democracies. Populism is now part of the furniture. It's already changed, so just get used to it. And let's remember historically that 100 years ago, the people who were populist then, the people that everyone was afraid of, became the established parties in many cases, Blythe told Ideas host Nala Ayed. So every now and again, you have to have a little revolution, and that's what's happening now. Populism is springing up on the right and the left, said Blythe. The difficult choices that need to be made about climate change could come from a left-wing populist movement, not unlike the so-called Green New Deal proposed by younger American Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Looking at how things may unfold in the not-too-distant future, Blythe speculates, right populism wins round one. But ultimately, left populism wins round two because left populism is the only one that takes climate change seriously, he concludes. Well, I don't know about you, dear listeners and viewers, but I think there's a hole in his argument. I think he's assuming that the world's citizens are rational enough and educated well enough to figure this out. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself. Here's another article by Lauren Martinchek. If everything was rational, we would have revolted by now. Understanding the scope of the trauma and pain that the American people have been subjected to. As I have said now countless times before, it feels as though with each passing week there is something new to add to the grim nature of the reality that the American people are currently facing in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic and the economic crisis it has ushered in along with it. I'm sure I'm not alone in getting the sense that the pain and trauma has become so widespread it's almost commonplace, as if it has just become another innate aspect of our lives that we have learned to accept. In all honesty, I'm not sure how else people could cope with the levels of pain and trauma without numbing themselves for the sake of their own mental health and sanity. And yet, one can't help acknowledging that given everything that we have been subjected to as a nation, if we were living in a period with any sense of rationality or logical outcomes and consequences, people would have revolted by now. To be clear, I do not make this point as a means through which to call for violent revolution. I do. I am not under the impression that the glorious revolution so many hope for wouldn't turn bloody, and I sincerely hope that we do not get to that point. Having said that, when considering everything that we have been living with over the past 7 months alone, it frankly seems incredible that it hasn't happened yet. Over 200,000 people are dead. 200,000 people are gone forever, dying alone in hospital beds, drowning in their own fluids, leaving millions of loved ones behind, not only to mourn their loss, but to deal with the added layer of grief that comes with knowing they couldn't even be there to hold their hand when they went. Granted, in the case of a global health pandemic in a nation the size of ours, tens of thousands of deaths are inevitable. But 150,000 of those lives were lost as a direct result of our government's unwillingness to do what is necessary to protect them, not because it couldn't. Every single day, 1,000 more graves are dug for the bodies lost as collateral damage, all for the sake of feeding our dying, end-stage capitalist empire's economy, an economy that demands a return to normalcy in the middle of a raging pandemic so that corporations and their CEOs can see a healthy profit margin at the end of the quarter, while workers all across the country put their bodies on the line to make just enough to survive, if that. Every single day, children too young to even understand what is being asked of them are being thrown to the wolves, sent back to school, and risking not just their own health and safety, but the health and safety of everyone close to them, all so that someone can profit off of their parents' labor. Meanwhile, lawmakers who call this the greatest nation on earth are actively working to make sure that insurance companies can deny these children who catch the virus healthcare coverage on the basis of a pre-existing condition. After all, the fact that our government turned their long-term health into an unknown for the sake of corporate greed makes them a liability to the almighty bottom line. As if that alone wouldn't be enough in a rational world to motivate people to take to the streets, there's the layer of the economy as well. Through no fault of their own, tens of millions of people are now not able to put food on the table for their families, let alone make rent or mortgage payments. Every single day, a mother who lost her job through no fault of her own is putting her bank account into overdraft just to buy diapers for her baby. If she is lucky enough to get another check from the government deposited into her account, the bank will make sure it goes to them first. At the same time, government, which has only just come to the realization that the single means-tested $1,200 check of our own money was not going to be enough to get people through this crisis, handed hundreds of billions of dollars over to corporations to bail them out after their artificially inflated stock prices tanked in the wake of the crisis. While 1 in 4 young adults contemplated suicide as the situation grows more and more dire, Jeff Bezos nearly doubled his wealth as a direct result of this pandemic. As more and more people in the richest nation on earth wonder how they'll pay for their next meal, our lawmakers went home to solicit high-dollar campaign contributions with their salaries still paid by the taxpayer. Well, technically speaking, their salaries were paid by the Federal Reserve Bank. If we lived in a period of time where logical conclusions could be expected, our legislators would be terrified to show their faces in public. If I'm being honest, I wish, from the very bottom of my heart, that they were, because that is exactly what callous sociopaths of the highest order, with the blood of hundreds of thousands of people on their hands, deserve. Today at work, my 106-year-old resident cried into my shoulder after a Zoom call with her children because she missed them so much. We are quite literally living in a failed state. A state that, as I have said before, failed not because it couldn't meet the needs of its people, but because it made the calculated decision that it simply was not going to. Instead, they have brought us to our knees, bombarding us with so much shock, awe, stress, and despair, we can barely take a moment to breathe, let alone organize against them effectively. But just because they haven't been met with the rage yet doesn't mean they won't if something doesn't change. There are only so many times people can be kicked in the teeth and have their basic humanity denied before the ticking time bomb our government has actively created goes off. I don't know when that will be, what will cause it, or what will ultimately result. But the feeling that we're living within a giant pressure cooker only grows more intense by the day. As the election approaches and the president has made it clear to the most militant amongst his supporters that they should be ready for violence in the aftermath, it seems as though we're rapidly approaching a moment that is going to shake this country to its core. It feels as though America has been a case study for how long the masses can be desensitized to the brutality inflicted upon them before they say enough. How much longer are they going to keep pushing us? The sad part is that an elitist couldn't have written that article. The elitists who typically write the articles that we read, who put out the news bulletins that we watch on television, are not in touch with this kind of pain. So they say things like James here, why leftists should vote for Joe Biden. And then he says stupid shit like, a vote for Joe Biden is not the same as supporting him. We have to stop acting like it is. Now, who could say such a thing but a condescending, elitist asshole? And left populists and right populists both should feel offended by this brand of dumb shittery. And this article isn't appealing to people who are in pain. This article is trying to make the case for people who are comfy. But what I've said before is I'm not sure people who are comfy should even try to call themselves leftists unless they understand why people are in pain. Hell, they don't even know that people are in pain because they haven't felt the pain themselves. I'm not even going to read this stupid shit to you because it makes me feel like going out into the street and setting fire to the oligarchic property I see around me. And I wouldn't feel that bad about it because people like Warren Buffett, who own insurance companies, would have to foot the bill. The main point I've been angling for here today is that left populists and right populists should learn to stick together. If you're not afraid of women in the workforce, or black and brown people, or people from other countries, then you need to understand that we have to solve the economic problems before we can solve the social problems. If you are someone who is afraid of women in the workforce, black and brown people in the workforce, in additional numbers, and people from other countries, then you also must figure out that you're blaming the wrong people. Economic scarcity and austerity is the root problem, but we all have to get together on who should be held accountable. So, dear viewers and listeners, if you know anyone on the right side of the aisle, and if that person is a populist, and if they could even hear these arguments with just a little bit of open-mindedness, please share it with them. I don't think we're going to have the mojo to do what needs to be done unless we can somehow unite all of the people who have been damaged by austerity, who have been damaged by lacking the basic necessities of life. And if there's an answer for the question that Lauren first posed, why haven't we revolted already? That may be the missing puzzle piece. We haven't yet united the right populists with the left populists. And if that could ever happen, then I think we'd have the mojo to get a country that works for we the people. And we could avoid the failed experiments of the past that led to authoritarian forms of government. Uniting the struggling workers on both the right and the left is the answer, I think, that we should all be striving for now. And the only way we're going to achieve that is through the widespread sharing of the kind of messages that are shared on this show and in these articles.